This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 193, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free on Patreon. This week, I'm talking to Eric Nansteel about his book, Angst in the Shadows, a true story of alien abductions. Eric has had lifelong encounters with non-human entities. His work has been featured on Ancient Aliens and Dreamland with Whitley Strieber, and his case is the subject of an official MUFON investigation. Well, hi, Eric. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hi, Simon. Thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called Angst in the Shadows, a true story of alien abductions. Before we talk about you, first of all, I'd like to ask about 1953 and the incident on Clugston Avenue. What happened there?
Yes, in 1953, my mother, her name at the time was Betty Jackson, was 9 years old, and she had seven siblings, and she lived with her parents, and most of her siblings that were still at the house at that time. And there was one night where she was in her kitchen with her mother and her younger brother, Billy. And two of her older brothers burst into the kitchen from outside. They saw something, and they burst in and they exclaimed, "Hey, you know, Mom, Betty, we saw a UFO flying above the valley." Now, they lived on top of a hill called Rose Hill in Turtle Creek, Pennsylvania, which is a suburb of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in the western part of the state. And so they saw a UFO flying across the valley, and then it sort of hovered, and they saw it was spinning, it had lights, and then it shot up and out of sight very quickly. You know, obviously not an airplane behaving in that manner. And so they burst into the kitchen, and they told my mom, Betty, and their mother, Gertrude, "Hey, we saw this UFO." So everybody runs outside, and they look up into the sky. There's no UFO. It's gone. It had left. But then that night, my mother had a strange experience, which in and of itself could be dismissed as a dream and just forgotten. But given the context of what came later in both of our lives, it sure seems to point to abduction. About 2:30 in the morning, my mother, she had her own bedroom, even though it was a very small house. But she was the youngest girl, so she had her own bedroom on the upstairs. About 2:30 in the morning, she woke up, and she felt compelled to go down into the coal cellar. Now, back then, the basements were very dirty, you know, dirt floor, and it used to have an entrance to an old coal mine, but it had been bricked up because there were coal mines going through those hills, and each of the houses on top of that hill had access to those coal mines. So it was kind of neat, but it was a dirty, disgusting place. No place for a 9-year-old to be at 2:30 in the morning, but she felt compelled to go downstairs, and she couldn't explain why. So she snuck out of her room and went down the stairs past her parents' bedroom and into the kitchen and opened the cellar door, turned on a little light at the top of the stairs, and the light just kind of, you know, shone down, but you know, the light like barely makes to the base of the stairs, right? And it's very dark down there. But she felt compelled. There's just something she had to check on. She didn't understand it. So she walks down 3 or 4 steps down the stairs, a creaky wooden stairs, and there's a railing. And then she freezes, and she can't move. And then she notices something coming out of the shadows, two figures, but when she can resolve what they are, they appear to be two German shepherds. And they're growling, and they lunged up the stairs toward her. And as soon as they reached her, she blacked out. And the next thing she knows, she's back in her bedroom, and she's waking up in her bed. And it's only like, I don't know, 3 a.m. or something like that. So it's not long after, you know, after she woke up, but she dismissed it as a dream. it wasn't until I started telling her about my experiences and the phenomenon called screen memories that triggered the memory. She's like, oh, you know, my brother saw a UFO above the valley. And then I had this experience and she told me all the details about it. And I said, Mom, I've had so many screen memories where during an abduction encounter, visually what I'm seeing is like a gray alien, either a small one or one of the tall ones. And, but at the time I'm believing it's somebody I know or a type of person I know, you know, and, when I wake up, my visual memory is still intact. And I remember, oh, that wasn't a person, but I believed it was something else. And so they have a way of obfuscating your memory by, planting some kind of, I'd call it a post-hypnotic suggestion. Like you're seeing something that you're not. You're seeing something else other than what you're really seeing. And so Whitley Strieber talked about this phenomenon in communion, and he saw what he thought was a barn owl through his kitchen window. And under hypnosis, he was able to see that it was actually a gray alien. So I told her about these screen memories, and that's what triggered the memory of that event.
So with your memories, is it that you were, you know, well into adulthood before you started thinking back about childhood and thinking, hang on a second, something was going on there?
Well, I remember very clearly, I mean, my entire life, I remember the white orbs that used to come into my bedroom between the ages of 1 and 5. But I had no context for it. I didn't think it was aliens. I didn't know what it was. When I told my mother, I was still quite young when I told her about those orbs of light, and she said, oh, that must be angels. You're special. And I thought, well, isn't it nice to be special? You know, I'm spiritually special or something like that. So it's just one of those things in childhood. You just don't think too much about it. But it was in 1994 when I was 25, that's when I first saw grays in my bedroom. And but we're jumping ahead in the timeline to get to that point.
So what did the orbs do? Did they just kind of float around the room and go, or was it other things happening? Communication?
No, the orbs were very direct and, dare I say, aggressive. My first memories are when I was still, gosh, I was only 15 or 16 months old. And we're talking maybe spring or summer of 1970. And I remember being in my crib. I remember where the crib was in relation to the rest of the room. I remember the color of the walls. I remember where the diaper changing station was. I remember everything. And normally I wouldn't, but you have this very vivid thing that just burns into your mind's eye. And because it happened several times, that helps like retain the memory. So I remember standing up in my crib. I was wearing a one piece, neck to foot pajamas that button up the front with crinkly plastic soles on the bottom of the feet. I remember standing up and holding the side rail of my crib, which is bizarre to me that I can remember anything from that age, but I do. And I was looking at the closet, and through the closet door, now the closet's big enough to accommodate an adult human standing up inside the closet, even though the door would be closed. And, but through the closet door came this bright white glowing ball of plasma that I'd say was about the size of somewhere between a softball and a basketball, but closer to the size of a softball, a little bigger than a softball. And I don't know if you play softball in the UK, so I hope that's not a strange context. But it came through the wall and was crossed the room toward my crib at about the speed of an adult walking. And it reached my forehead, and I would black out. And the same thing repeated itself many times over the course of 4 years. And Sometimes it would come through the window, the wall, but usually the closet door. And I never understood why, but I eventually developed a fear of closets, a little later on in childhood. And I started having nightmares about closets, about lights jumping out of closets and getting me. That's how often these orbs are coming for me. And every time they'd come for me, they'd reach my forehead and I would pass unconscious.
I wonder if they were screen memories.
No, I don't think so, because a lot of people report these orbs. And my mother told me that in 1974, now 1974 was the last time, the last year that I had seen the orbs. My mother started having dreams during the period of time where I was seeing orbs in physical reality coming at me in my bedroom as a child. My mother was having recurring dreams that felt like nightmares where these hundreds of white orbs would descend out of the sky. And I would be with her and my father, and we were walking home from a friend's house. And these white orbs in her dream would descend out of the sky and pursue us. And we would try to evade these white orbs by ducking into neighbors' backyards and hiding behind sheds and running over to another tree and just trying to hide. But the orbs would catch up to us and shine a beam of light down onto us. And my mother said every time they caught up to us, when she would have this dream, I would be taken. So she's dreaming about me being taken by white orbs at the same period of time where I'm seeing white orbs enter my room and rendering me unconscious. So this tells me that she knew, but it also tells me that that period of time she was being taken too, because they started with her in the early 50s. And then here we are in the early to mid 70s. And she's having dreams that are related to what's happening to me. And that goes beyond coincidence, Simon.
Was it you were in hospital and there was a boy in the room with you called Tommy and something happened with him?
Yes, Tommy. We don't remember his surname. I wish I did. I would love to find him if he's still alive. I mean, we're pushing 60, so who knows? But so in 1974, I was in the hospital for observation and testing related to a mild concussion I had received in one of those jumpy bounce houses. And yes, they did have those in the early 70s. And, you know, I went in there for EEGs and stuff, and it was I was fine. There, it was just precaution. But on my last night at the hospital, just before I fell asleep, I saw a white orb enter my room through the hallway door. Now, back then, our room had glass windows reinforced with wires. Have you ever seen those crisscrossing wires and reinforced windows before?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm nearly 60 as well. I remember them.
Yeah, okay. Well, they had them. This was at Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois. And so there was a window like that in the doorway, and it was covered by a white linen curtain. So you could still see some light coming in from the hallway, even though it was dark in our room and we were about to go to sleep. But this orb just comes right through that window and comes at me in my bed and touches my forehead, and I pass unconscious. And I wake up in the morning, and that's the morning that my mother was going to come for me and we were going to leave the hospital. And I was excited because I didn't like being there. And but that night, I had gained a roommate named Tommy. And Tommy had a large infected abscess in his abdomen that was killing him. He had a fever that would spike up to 110 degrees Fahrenheit at times. And they had him on an ice mattress that he was laying on to keep his body cool. And they had him, full of tubes and antibiotics and those kinds of things, you know, the drip bags. And he was very sick. He was very weak. And I was intimidated. I didn't want to talk to him because he was just too sick. And so I was a sensitive child at the time, and I just didn't want to be around him because it just kind of creeped me out. And but I look back and I'm like, poor Tommy. But Tommy's mother stayed with him all night. And she was just laying by his side. And so my mother came to me for me that morning to collect me and say goodbye to Tommy. And my mother had bought a little gift to give Tommy from the hospital gift shop. And before we left, my mother gave me the little gift. It was a little toy truck or something like that. And she handed it to me and she said, "Eric, now go say goodbye to Tommy and give him this present." And I said, "Mommy, I don't want to talk to Tommy. He's dying." And she said, "Eric, you have to say goodbye to him. It's a nice thing to do." And so I was kind of exasperated, but like, okay, fine. So I walked over to Tommy's bed. And at that time, Tommy and his mother and my mother were like talking to each other near the door of the room, the hallway door. And so I approached Tommy, and he had these little set of wooden stairs, for children to be able to climb up into these hospital beds. It was three steps. And I climbed up the little three steps, and I climbed into bed with him. And I just took that little toy, and I'm like, "Here." And I just kind of set it near his head. And then I instinctively just took my hands and I placed them on his torso. His chest and his belly and his abdomen. And I was rubbing my hands up and down his torso. And mind you, I'm barely 5 years old here. And I just had this thought that I could help him. It was just this overwhelming assumption or knowledge or something that I could help this boy. And so I touched him and I placed my hands on him up and down. And then I said, "There, now you're going to be all better." And I climb down off of his bed, and my mother and I leave, and I'm running down the hallway, exclaiming to everybody, "I have magic hands." And for me, that was the end of it. I hadn't heard about Tommy again after that, not for many years, but my mother told me the story. She told me that the very next day, Tommy's mother called my mother. Because they had exchanged numbers before we left. And she told my mother that when the doctors came in to check on Tommy, they were even considering possible surgery, just whatever, to like go in and take this infected abscess, this big mass out of his abdomen to save his life. They didn't know. They weren't sure what to do. But it was gone. His fever was gone. He was totally fine. And Tommy's mother thought it was a miracle, and she told my mom, and she attributed what I did to having had something to do with that. And for the longest time, I had forgotten that the orb had visited me the night before. And I was just thinking, "Oh, I'm just a spiritually special kid that can heal people." You know, but I don't think that was it. I am now taking that experience and a later one in which I healed my grandfather. But I was taking those two experiences. I take those now in the context of these orbs visiting me. I think they're related because the orb visited, and then I did this thing to this boy, and I think they're related. And the reason why I think that is because much later in adulthood, not to jump too far ahead in the timeline, but the Grays that I interacted with healed me, my GI tract, which was very sick at the time. And so they have that ability. So I'm thinking maybe they helped him or they helped him through me, but I don't take credit for it. I think it had something to do with these encounters that I've had.
So with these encounters that you've had, Do you feel more like a victim or a participant?
I would say that I didn't know I was an abductee until the year 2020. I didn't consider myself an abductee because I was being visited by orbs. I didn't consider myself an abductee in 1994 when I woke up suddenly and startled four small grays that whooshed out of my room faster than anybody could run. They were propelled out of my room. I didn't consider myself an abductee even then. It was just like, whoa, this is a weird thing that just happened to me. And I certainly didn't connect the grays in my bedroom in 1994 with the orbs yet, because I hadn't done any research. And the internet didn't exist, so I couldn't communicate with other people. And pretty much the only thing you ever learned was like through books and like rented videos and things like that. But in 2020, when things started happening, at first I didn't feel like a victim. I was just like astonished that these things were happening, that I've met and interacted with these strange beings, these people that look very different from us. But over the course of 4 years of regular abductions every 4 to 6 weeks, I began to feel like a lab rat. And my entire value to them was genetic and nothing else. I don't like these things. I don't like the grays, and I believe that their agenda is nefarious. That's all I can say about that. Well, I can say more, but yeah.
And also, you say in the book, you were talking about one of your encounters, and you said, just as before, my fear response was almost non-existent. Because for me, I think if I woke up and found four greys in my bedroom, I'd be petrified. But you were kind of, was it like you were dulled down or something?
That's exactly right. My first encounter of 2020 happened after, let me back up a little bit. In early 2020, between January and March, things were being disturbed in my room. Maybe once a month, between when I'd go to bed at night and when I'd wake up in the morning, something was changed or different in my room. And I am not a sleepwalker, so I don't walk around my room half asleep, bumping things, knocking things over, or changing things. But little things started to happen, and there was no explanation other than somebody coming into my room and doing that. And it seems a little paranoid. But so that's why I dismissed it the first time it happened. But then after three incidents, I started questioning, like, all right, I'm creeped out here. Something's happening in my room. So I did an experiment. I put a sign on my wall that had an illustration of a small gray alien and a note saying, I want to remember your visit, because I remembered these things that were in my room in 1994. And I was thinking, well, maybe it was them. Maybe they're back. It was just an instinct. I can't explain it. I can't, why am I thinking about something that happened 26 years ago? And because some strange things happened in my bedroom that I can't explain, why do I automatically default to something 26 years ago where I saw these small grays? I can't answer that, but it was just an instinct. And so I put the sign on my wall that said, I want to remember your visit. Please let me remember you. I will not harm. And for 2 weeks, that sign was on my bedroom wall above my headboard on my bed. And 2 weeks later, I woke up in my garage and I was... mostly naked, except for the briefs that I wear to bed. And I was hovering off the floor. My feet were off the floor by 6 or 8 inches. And I was tilted forward at a 30-degree angle in my cold garage. I mean, we're talking, this is April 2020. So it's still quite cool in early spring. And I'm looking down at a small gray alien. You know, one of those little skinny bobs. You ever see the skinny bob Soviet video?
Yeah, I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah, well, I know, I understand it's controversial because some moron put After Effects on the video to make it look like it could have been hoaxed, but I'm sure it's real because that's what they look like, the small ones. And that's how they move too. So I'm looking down at this little skinny Bob Gray. And like I said, I'm in my garage. And to my left is my was my red Chevy Trailblazer. It's a large SUV. And then to the right of me is the side door of the garage and a side window. And through the side window was white light streaming in, illuminating the left side of Skinny Bob here, this little gray. And so other than that, the garage was completely dark. So this light was coming in the side window, and it was like dancing, like the light was streaming in like beams. It was strange, but illuminating him on one side. And I couldn't feel anything. I could only move my head. I was paralyzed. And normally I would have been like, because your question is about my fear response. Normally I would have been petrified. I'm like, why can't I move? Why am I hovering? Why am I floating above my freaking floor? And I'm looking down at the strange being, you know, I've never met one of these things before. And it was a powerful, visceral experience burned into my retinas, but I couldn't feel anything physically. And my fear response was non-existent. It was a moment of pure awareness, but at the same time, my emotions were not there. I was just there to observe. It was a very weird feeling, Simon. And it spoke to me in my mind, words placed in my mind. And he said, in response to that sign, apparently above my bed, it said, "We cannot allow you to remember our visit or my superiors would know about it." And before I could formulate a sentence in my mind, because my mind was like, it's a little like being drunk, Simon. I was not drinking, but it's a little like being drunk without the buzz and without the, you know, but you're paralyzed. So it's not like you're clumsy, you're just paralyzed. But your nervous system, it's as though they can dial down the volume on your nervous system to like 2 or 3 out of 100. You know, you're operating at very low levels. And that's what it's like. And so there was no fear response, even though I should have been very afraid. And the next encounter that happened exactly 1 week later was even worse. And I should have attacked these things and I couldn't. I was paralyzed and my fear response was gone. So I don't blame them for taking precautions with me.
That's what I was going to ask you. In these encounters, if you weren't paralyzed, what would you have done?
Well, the very next week, I woke up in bed and there was a tall gray. He's different from the small ones. There was a tall gray and 4 small grays, short grays. Next to the bed, but there's a tall gray on top of me. And he wasn't really putting his weight on me. I mean, he wouldn't have weighed much. I mean, maybe 80 pounds max, but he was kind of like propping himself up above me and he was staring me in the face. Now, if it wasn't for the muted fear response and if it wasn't for the physical paralysis, I would have grabbed this thing by the neck and shot out of bed and whipped him against the wall. I'm 220 pounds. I could have dominated this thing physically. I don't, you know, I know some tall grays are much taller, like 7-8 feet tall, but this thing was only about 5.5 feet tall. He was taller than the little ones. I think maybe he was a juvenile tall gray. I'm not sure, but he had no clothing on. So he was on top of me and he had his face like 6 inches from my face. And he was trying to get me to look him in the eyes. And I was just like, it was like agape, like just like complete fascination and awe, complete awareness, very awake, very conscious, but unable to think clearly, unable to feel anything emotionally, but still intimidated. So I did not want him to look him in the eye. So I was looking at his shoulder and I was noticing the texture of his skin. It was like elephant gray. It was like smooth, almost like leather, kind of it had surface texture, but it was smooth, like fine leather. And I wanted to touch his shoulder. I wanted to feel what it felt like. And it seemed to understand that because suddenly my left arm was able to move. And so I positioned my hand between the tight spaces between our chests, and I put my four fingers on top of his shoulder and my thumb was on his collarbone. And yes, they have a collarbone. They're physically, their skeleture, you know, system is very, very much like ours. You know, he had a clavicle. And so I was feeling his collarbone with my thumb and rubbing the top of his shoulder, like his shoulder blade, with my the tips of my four fingers, and I was fascinated. And this thing had zero subcutaneous fat. It was very sinewy, bony, muscular, very tight, very taut skin, and so I was fascinated by that. So I had calmed down enough. I was less intimidated after having been able to touch him, to look him in the eye. So I looked him in the eye, and then his eyes were like deep and black, you know, and then he moved his head forward toward mine. He touched his forehead to my forehead, and then I passed unconscious, but was suddenly in a dream state. So I went from being fully conscious to asleep, but in a dream state. And in this dream state, this tall gray was in that dream too. And the three small grays that were with us in the room now resembled three little German girls, like blonde haired, blue eyed. And they had, you know, these little blue dresses on, and they were identical height. It was very surreal. It kind of reminded me of Stanley Kubrick's
Is it The Shining?
Yeah, The Shining. The two little girls at the end of the hallway.
Yeah.
Except there was three of them. Yeah. So we were in a Bavarian village. We were standing on a cobblestone street. It was slightly sloped, and about 200 feet down the slope was a building and half timbered architecture, just like you'd see, you know, the crisscrossing brown timbers with the stucco between the timbers. Like, you know, and then there was like this little grassy slope with the, you know, stone steps going up. I remember very clearly. And it kind of looked like I had to go online to look at some historic, German villages, and it sort of resembled, some of the more historic, the older sections of Nuremberg is what it reminded me of. So anyway, I'm staring at this tall gray in this dream environment in this Bavarian village, and I was able to talk to him. I was able to ask him a couple of questions, not good questions, because I wasn't completely in command of all my faculties in this dream state. But I did ask him a few questions, and I asked him, what is your name? And he said, Sizzlick. And I wasn't sure I heard him correctly, so I bent down and I talked to the three little girls near us. I didn't understand that they could hear his thoughts like I could. And I said, he said his name is Sizzlick or Silizik. And then I stood up again, and I was talking to him, the tall one. And I said, are you from Zeta 2 Reticuli? And the reason why I knew about that is because back in the 90s, I had learned about the Betty and Barney Hill story and how Marjorie Fish, an amateur astronomer and school teacher, had taken Betty Hill's star map and identified the system. And, you know, because after I had that thing with the four grays whoosh out of my room, I did a little research into ufology because it was like I was fascinated. I was curious. So I read about some of that stuff. But we're talking about things I'd read from 25 years ago. So now I'm talking to this thing called Sizzalik and just like trying to bring up things I'd read 25 years ago. And so when I asked him, are you from Zeta 2 Reticuli? And he said, yes. And another thing I had read was about the what our military calls our planet. And I said, do you call your planet Serpo? And he said, we don't call it that. But then he didn't tell me what they call it. So we had a little bit of back and forth like that. And so I bent down and I told the three little girls standing next to us, you know, the things that Sizzalik was saying to me. And then the one in the middle, the little girl in the middle, the little gray, looked up at me in the eyes and said, you know, you're nice. We were told you would be mean. And then that just kind of struck me. I'm like, what? Mean? What? Why would you think of, you know, so before I could ask a question, why did you hear I was mean? I went unconscious. And then when I woke up, they were gone. They were out of my room. But then I heard my daughter laughing in the next room. She has autism, severe nonverbal autism. And by this point, she's already an adult. She was like 23 years old. And she was giggling and laughing in her bedroom like somebody was interacting with her. And so I jumped out of bed and I rushed into her room and she was alone but very awake. And I thought, well, she only wakes up if like her pull-up diaper that she wears at bed at night, if it were wet. So I check her pull-up and her pull-up is dry. I believe you guys call them nappies. I don't know.
Yeah.
So her nappy was dry and there's no reason for her to have woken up. And so I was puzzled by that. So I decided to do a walking tour of the house. So I put my daughter back to bed and I closed her door and I tour the whole house and there's nobody there, nothing there. But that was freaky. In hindsight, I believe that tall gray was there to investigate why or how I knew or suspected even that the grays were visiting me. I think he was there to investigate. I think he was one of the superiors that the little skinny Bob in the garage told me about. But that was the beginning. That was the beginning of 4 years of nearly monthly encounters. And I remember more than a dozen.
And is it still happening today?
No, I don't. My last memory of an abduction was, I believe, in March of 2024. If I had had any after March, I don't remember them. I think at one point, if they didn't enjoy the interactions with me or whatever, but at some point they might have just stopped letting me wake up during encounters. But I developed a theory. They seem to come for 4 year rotations on a 4 to 6 month or 4 to 6 week basis for 4 years. And then there seems to be a roughly a 20-year gap between rotations because they bothered my mother in the early 50s. And the early 70s, and that's when they started bothering me in the early 70s. And then they came back for me in the early to mid 90s. And then they came back for me again in 2020 for 4 years. So they seem to have a 4 year rotational schedule with 20 year gaps, roughly, even though it was actually 26 years. But I'm not sure the last year that they bothered me in the 90s. I had some experiences in 1994 and 1995. But I only saw the grays in one incident in 1994. But yeah, so just so many visits, and I just started talking about it to my friends and my family because I didn't want to forget anything. So I was telling them every single detail. But it's yeah. So I had enough to talk about. I put into a book.
Did you ever set up like a video camera or a trail cam or something?
That would be a brilliant idea, and I should have thought of it. I'm not certain it would have worked because these things are so far in advance of us. I think they could easily detect one of our little low-tech cameras. But it might have been worth a shot. And in 20 years, when I'm in my 60s and 70s or 70s, mid to late 70s, I think maybe a trail cam would be a good idea. I might have aged out. I don't know. I'm getting past a point where, you know, at my advancing age that I'm not sure that whether it's my sperm count or whatever, but I imagine they might be going on to younger subjects soon.
One of the things I love about your book is the pictures that you've put together. Is it the computerized graphics?
Did you see the website? Because those have the color pictures are in there.
No, I haven't looked at that. I'm going to check that out because it really brings it to life.
That's angstintheshadows.com. And I put a gallery of images that I've illustrated in there. I'm a graphic designer and art director, and it was important to me to communicate visually what I saw in these encounters and to make it accurate enough so you can see exactly what I experienced. I was fortunate to find some 3D models that were poseable that looked like these beings that I saw. So I found a 3D model of a skinny Bob. I mean, that's them. That's exactly what the short grays look like. I mean, it was just, so like, I was so happy I was able to purchase a 3D model and use it in my little digital dioramas. And then I found some models of tall grays that were close enough in appearance to what I saw. Not 100% accurate, but I really just wanted to like set the scene so people could see what I saw. And that's why I did those illustrations.
Could you tell us about the time you woke up and you had a terrible pain in your arm?
Yes. This was in 2022. And I was asleep and I felt pain in my left arm. It was excruciating. It started as an ache. And then as I woke up and became more conscious, it became a much sharper pain. And I woke up, opened my eyes, and I noticed I was not in my bedroom. I was in a room with gray walls. And I looked down at my feet, and I noticed I was on a pewter gray metallic table. It was a very smooth, featureless surface that I was laying on, a hard, cold metal table. But I say cold, but I couldn't really feel the cold. The way that they manipulate your nervous system, it's difficult to feel much of your ambient environment. But I did feel my arm hurting. So I looked down at my arm, and it's not there. It's missing from above the elbow. My left arm. It was missing. I couldn't even take that into my model of reality in my head. It made no sense. I looked down and I'm just shocked. Like, you know, I don't have an elbow or anything below. It's just gone. But there's no blood coming out of my body. And I'm looking. I try to turn my head to the right, and I couldn't turn my head to the right. But I was aware of motion of Someone was to my right doing something on that side of the room. But I was able to move my head a little bit to the left, and I saw it. A metal cart, like a table, on a single shaft, like holding it up, you know, like a medical tray table, you know, that you might see in a surgical theater, you know, where doctors do surgeries or something. And it had slightly raised a rim along its edges, but my arm was laying on that table and I could, you know, I could see, you know, the elbow and everything was all there, but I could see my humerus bone they cut the humerus bone. So I could see the bone sticking out of the meat, out of the muscle, but there was no blood, not a drop of blood, Simon, on this table, on the table I was laying on, not a drop of blood on the cart that was holding my arm, not a drop of blood. And I don't know how that's possible. It doesn't make any sense, but here I'm looking at freshly butchered meat. That's me. That's my meat. It was freaky. I'm at a loss of eloquence when I recall the memory, and but I was in deep pain. It was so painful. But before I could think of something or try to figure out my situation, I went unconscious again. And I woke up, who knows how many hours later, but I woke up and I was back at home and I look at the clock and it's like 5:45 a.m., which is usually when I would normally wake up in the morning. And my arm is killing me. So I'm like, all right, well, that was no dream. So I look down and my arm is fully intact and I'm examining my arm. And there's no sutures, no scarring, no visible sign of trauma other than swelling in my elbow, and it's very painful. And so I could move my arm a little bit, the elbow a little bit, but not a lot. It lacked a range of motion because of the pain. So I got up and I took a shower, a nice hot shower. I thought maybe a shower would loosen me up a little bit. And by the time I'd finished the shower, the elbow had completely frozen solid. I couldn't move it at all, and it was bent at a 90-degree angle. And it stayed that way for a month, 4 weeks. It was very swollen. But apparently they had done some damage. So they came back the next week, and the next time I had an encounter, they came back to check my arm. I woke up on not a metal table this next time. I woke up on what could be construed as a type of bed. It was a cushioned mattress with a cloth wrap on it that was very tight, and it was reminded me of soft white canvas. And somebody was holding my hand to my right, and a tall gray was examining my left arm on the left. He was bent over the side of the bed and he had his hands on my arm, and he was inspecting the elbow and he's moving his hands up and down my left arm. But anyway, somebody was holding my hand, and I looked to my right, and whatever they used to give you screen memories, they were really trying to make that stick, because I was perceiving this small person holding my hand as a girl. But in my visual memory later on, when I'm back at home and I wake up again, I remembered it. Yeah, that was a small gray. But so this small female thing was holding my hand, and her feet only reached about down by my knees. And she was looking at me, and I was looking at her, and she said to me, "Do you have something you want to tell me?" Now, these are words in my mind. She did not speak this verbally with her mouth. She said with words in my mind, "Do you have something you want to tell me?" And I couldn't think of anything, and I was very confused in the moment. I was very disoriented. I didn't know what was going on. And I thought maybe this female thing was trying to flirt with me, which is a strange thing to think. But I said, well, I'm not married or anything. I don't know why I would say such a thing. Plus, I don't go for short girls. I like tall girls. So as soon as I said that, I fell unconscious and I woke up and I was back in my bed in my house. And I look at my arm and I have a slightly increased range of motion, but the pain is still there. And now normally I told you that they come every 4 to 6 weeks. Well, because of this arm incident with the surgery, they came the very next week to check on my arm. And then the very next week again, I woke up a week later after the thing where the little one was holding my hand. I woke up a week later in a standing position in a gray room, staring at a gray wall that had a kind of a railing mounted to it. And it reminded me the kind of railing that you would see in a dance studio that the ballet ballerinas would hold on to as they do their stretches and their exercises. You've seen those, right?
Yeah.
Well, there was a gray railing mounted to this wall, and I was being led toward this gray railing. I was very unsteady on my feet. Like I said, I woke up in a standing position, but I was very clumsy. And a tall gray that was easily 7 feet tall, you know, I'm 5'10", and this thing was towering at least 2 feet over my head, guided me to this railing and instructed me, not with words, but I just knew I was supposed to hold on to this railing. And once I had gained my bearings and I was steady on my feet, this tall gray grabbed my shoulders and gently rotated me toward it. And facing this tall gray, it reached toward my left arm and started moving its hands up and down over the elbow again, like before. And then I woke up, and sometime after that, because I'd fallen unconscious again, I woke up sometime after that. Again, I'm back at home, and my arm has a slightly better range of motion. But it took another full 2 weeks after that for the pain to go away. Now, since then, I had the theory that they went into my arm to take bone marrow. Maybe the semen collection wasn't enough for their whatever they're doing, the breeding program. I don't know. But they collected semen on many occasions from me. But this time I think it was about bone marrow, because some of the best places to take bone marrow are your hip, your ribs, and your humerus. Those are some of the best places for, you know, to get genetic material, stem cells and whatnot. So I was talking to ChatGPT about this, and I said, well, Chat, can you tell me what would be the physical effects of removing a significant portion of my bone marrow from my humerus? Would that cause swelling in my elbow? And I needed to know. I couldn't talk to a real doctor about this because, you know, they just look at you like you have six heads. And ChatGPT said, yes, one of the things would be a persistent pain until that bone marrow had grown back. And yeah, sure, it could affect the elbow and cause swelling. Sure. So I'm like, well, then that's probably what they did. I'm sure they took bone marrow. And on a later occasion, I'm pretty sure they took bone marrow out of my left hip, because it felt as though a needle had been stabbed into the bone when I woke up one morning, and very painful. And so I think they've taken bone marrow from me on at least two occasions.
Well, it's been great talking to you. The book's called Angst in the Shadows: A True Story of Alien Abductions, and people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Yes, also barnesandnoble.com and a few other retailers like walmart.com. I don't know if you have Walmarts in the UK, but Barnes & Noble, but certainly Amazon.
And the website is angstintheshadows.com.
That's correct, yes.
And do you have plans for another book?
I do. It's not about me or my abductions. It's about the grays and their involvement with humanity since the last ice age. And I call it a blood covenant. There's also a subtitle in there, but I'm not giving away everything yet. But basically, I'll be talking about, you know, what connects cultures across the globe that gives clues that the Greys are actually the ones behind all of these pyramid building societies. And I explain why most of them had blood sacrifice rituals and why they had blood sacrifice rituals and what the Greys were doing with these tissues that were sacrificed. And so I get into that, and it's quite fascinating. I think I have enough research to support my argument in the book. So I'm going forward with it. Plus, I've decided I want to write some fiction. So I'm writing some novels just for fun, and, you know, cinematic, military, alien conspiracy thrillers, lots of chase scenes, UFOs, abductions, all kinds of, it sounds like a mess, but I promise you it's very good. I've mapped out the plots for three novels. So, but that's, those won't be done for about at least a year, but my next book will be called A Blood Covenant. And that should be done by February.
Fantastic. Thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Simon. I deeply appreciate it. I apologize for the delay in our getting together. And I deeply appreciate your flexibility with my schedule. I really wanted to speak with you and your audience and talk about these experiences, because the more we talk about them, the more we can empower those who may have been afraid to speak out, and also maybe trigger some latent memories that some people had dismissed. Maybe there are some loose threads that they could pull on if they know where to find the threads. And you only find the threads when people can point them out to you.
And if anybody does have that, they can email me. I'd definitely like to know.
Absolutely.
And that was an interview with Eric Nansteel about his book, Angst in the Shadows, A True Story of Alien Abductions. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can get a 7-day free trial. And please check out my new book. It's called Verified Near-Death Experiences, and it's on Amazon. You can get it on audiobook, paperback, and Kindle. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.